like to hear all of her story. And I would like to introduce to you Susan Yu from New York City.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Susan. I'm an alcoholic. And 2 o'clock is a hard time to speak because when you're over 50, that is siesta nap time. And I was in the second row over there yesterday, dozing off a little. I'm sorry, old timers, forgive me. So I won't look at you if you're dozing off. I understand. It's so wonderful to be here and to be sober this beautiful, humid day in North Carolina. I'm just grateful every day to wake up now as I'm getting older and wake up and know that I'm still an alcoholic, and with all of you, and you offer me so much inspiration. There were 4 or 5. We love you. You'll be fine. And that is the inspiration of AA that keeps me going every day I wake up. This fellowship, as our former archivist from the office, who was Bill W.'s secretary, said, this is the greatest social movement of the 20th century. And I believe that it is. We are normally men and women who do not mix, and here we are. And the current archivist always says, well, you're a great-looking bunch of people. I would love to have had a drink with each one of you. And I think, well, I don't know, because I didn't want to share my bottle with anybody. So, and I thank the committee so much for including me this weekend in North Carolina. It's like a coming home again. I've been here before to some of your assemblies, and my son went to college down here for a few years. I've spent time with the former manager of our office, John and Mary, up in Asheville, and with Betty, who used to work with us at the office, and our cat, Lucky Trooper, was born here in North Carolina. And she was brought home by my son, and she lives in New York now. The committee has been so loving and generous. I started my trip out on Thursday on U.S. Air, and the plane was canceled. And I called Jim, the chair of the weekend, and told him that. And I was told that I'd get on at the 5 o'clock plane. But it's because of my wonderful hostess Marie, who picked me up, that she found out that I wasn't on that plane. And if she hadn't called New York, I would probably. I'm kind of casual and did not look into it and was just going to go to the airport. And so it's a good thing she called. I thank her. And that's why I missed the speaker on Thursday night, because the plane didn't come in till 8. But once you get here, you know, there's so much love here in North Carolina. I don't know how can anybody be but grateful to be sober here today and be part of this worldwide movement. And I've enjoyed the speakers. I've identified with the ones I've heard and look forward to the rest of the weekend. I hear so much of my story in each speaker and have lots of pearls of wisdom to take home. I used to go to these conventions and would hear an Al-Anon speaker and an AA speaker and would be so inspired if your spouse isn't with you or your family, and I'd bring all these pearls of wisdom home. Like I remember I heard one Al-Anon speaker who said that they prayed together as a family, and I took that home. Let's have some serenity prayer together. And I remember both my husband and son looked at me like I had almost flipped out or something. But I mean, I can see that you can't just come to these weekends and be so inspired and then go home and think that you can start something new. You know, so I realize also that the inspiration of the speakers and the whole convention atmosphere is something that is very hard to explain to others. It's in your heart and your soul, and it's the inspiration that we need to continue to carry the AA message. How many people are here at their first convention? That's terrific. My first convention was in 1973 at an IKIPA. So, my life began in 1938. I was born in New York City, a middle child. Apparently, my great grandfather was in business with John D. Rockefeller. In the grain business in Cleveland. And little did I know that John D. Rockefeller would have such an effect on Alcoholics Anonymous. I know that my great-grandfather was a big sailor, and he did not want to stay in this business because John D. Rockefeller was very interested in making a lot of money and worked all the time, whereas my great-grandfather enjoyed sailing and drinking, and so he got out of the business. And you know, I kind of enjoy hearing these things because I end up working in a building in New York that was built by John D. Rockefeller, and of course he is very famous in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, where he said that money would spoil us. This thing. And now he built a building in New York where I work now, and I don't know, I feel very kind of attached that I'm that I belong in this neighborhood. So I came along as a middle child. There are three of us in the family. My mother and father were wonderful parents who drank an awful lot, but neither one ever said that they were alcoholic, and so I tried not to diagnose them. My sister is older. She's, as I call her, the white sheep of the family. She would die if she ever heard one of my tapes. She'd be insulted, but she is perfect, and drinks a sip and puts it down for about an hour. And, you know, she just did all the right things. Then in regard to meeting the right man and being married to the same person all these years and having three wonderful children, as a matter of fact, I'm meeting one of her daughters tomorrow in Durham, my youngest niece, and for a little visit. And I was with my sister last week, and I really love her. We have a great relationship. I accept her as she is, and we were at another birthday party she proceeded to talk about flowers for 2 hours, you know, to remind me about how much she knows about this. And she is she's a very dedicated family member. You know, she's concerned about everybody else's problems. And I, you know, I've made my amends to her over the years there were many times in my drinking that I never showed up to babysit for her kids, and now I am in close touch with all of them. And she lives nearby. She lives up in Connecticut. And then I have my brother who is living on a boat in Honolulu Harbor. And he's an alcoholic too. And we're exactly alike. We are compulsive, dye-in-the-wool alcoholics. And drank the same way and took a little while to get sober. My parents were brains, and they went to Ivy League colleges, and you know, I always felt that I was a middle child, and that I could never be as smart as they are or anything else. And little by little, my brother reminds me, you know, people talk about their first drink, that we were drinking all along when we were out fishing with my father, because he never brought sodas for us. he just had beer. And so, I mean, apparently when we were out fishing growing up, that we had sips of beer when we were young. And I just know that I liked alcohol, and that I was a person who blushed a lot and was very shy and ill at ease with people, as you hear over and over again. And that when I started to drink, that really filled up this hole I had of not being as uptight or nervous, and that I could be a little looser. And a little, maybe, to the point of standing up on the bar, Cozy Cole's bar, and jitterbugging. Yeah. But I was good and drunk when I did things like that. I went to a college and right away, you know, started to hang out with a drinking crowd. And I think that was what the 50s was all about. I mean, your parents drank, and I was hanging out in these hard drinking schools, you know, it just became a way of life. I know that I abused the drinking privileges immediately in college, to the point of being on social and academic probation my first month there. And by the time I graduated from college, I was beginning to drink around the clock. And, you know, my fiancé at that time was a Dartmouth graduate, and we used to do things like ingest oranges with vodka, and you wake up in the morning from a fraternity party and you drink right away. And I always remember my first husband, Dennis, he said, the first time I met your father, it was at 10 o'clock in the morning. And he said, hello, Dennis, have a beer. So, I mean, it was a whole way of life that everybody was drinking. And the thing was, though, I observed that my drinking was 10 beers to, let's say, my sister's one. And that I drank too much. I got a teaching job in 1960, right out of school, and got married, and my husband said to me, we're not going to drink during the week. We need to save money for law school. Now, nobody had ever told me I couldn't drink, and so my logic was, well, I'll just drink behind your back. So I started to become a sneaky drinker, and I began to water the bottles that we had in the apartment, and I began to go to the liquor store every day, and always thinking, tomorrow I'll stop this. But I never stopped till I got here. My husband, I felt that I deserved a drink because I'm supporting him through law school. And pretty soon when he came home, he either came home to somebody who was passed out. I drank until I passed out. Or had disappeared. I would get in my car and disappear, or who had burned the dinner or eaten the whole dinner, trying to get rid of the vodka taste. You know, I just would keep eating it, saying, "Well, maybe that won't smell as much." And this was not very pleasant. And I heard this from Nell this morning. Living with an alcoholic is no day at the beach. And I heard the other side of it, and I can say anybody who does stick with the alcoholic, you deserve red ribbons and blue ribbons. I began to lie and I began to steal money sometimes from my father when we went to visit him, so I could get pints because we didn't have much money, and do things that I could never do today. I just did these things to get liquor. Eventually, my husband, I called him and my parents the CIA, because they were always talking behind my back about my behavior. An alcoholic either, it's a depressant, this alcohol. And whenever I got drunk, I can see that then I didn't want to live. And I was going to drive my car off the Tappan Zee Bridge or something like that. But every time I was sober, that feeling was not there. And so they sent me to a psychiatrist, and this psychiatrist told me the usual that they tell women, if you're living in the town where you teach, and you're a woman in this society, an educator, you need to cut down on your drinking. So here's some Librium to help you. And I remember just being kind of like a double zombie then, because I'd be walking around with Librium and a pint. And so eventually he suggested that I go to AA. So I made a phone call out of desperation one time when my husband had taken all my money, and I had called the liquor store and told them to deliver a pint to my parents' milk box or something, in the old-fashioned milk box outside the door. The pint came, but my husband could never figure out, in half an hour I could go from being sober to being drunk. But that's because you drink fast when you drink behind people. And I called AA, and two women came to 12-step me. And this is what the theme is this weekend, carrying the message. Two women carried the message to me. I was 24 years old, and we were dog sitting for my parents in their house, and they came to the door and they told me their stories. I said, "Well, I'm too young to be an alcoholic." And I remember Virginia said to me, "Well, you're not too young to have a problem with alcohol." And the other woman happened to be one of my high school friend's mother. So, I mean, it was just so shameful for me to have made this call. And so they told me to go to an AA meeting. And a few days later, I went to an AA meeting in the town in Riverdale, which is on the border of the Bronx, where my husband and I lived. And it was in a church with about, well, there were a lot of people there who looked about 75 years old to me. And I saw the steps on the wall and the traditions, and I saw a lot of words, God, who had abandoned me or I didn't use anymore. And I remember this old-timer said to me, well, Susan, you can stop now. And I said, John, he was 75, John, when I'm your age, I'll come to AA. And out the door I went, and within a week I was in my first detox. And it was in this detox that I met the big book. Not this little guy, but I read the big book. And every word in there was for me, but I could not stop drinking. The thing I loved the most was very hard to stop. And all I did was keep coming back. The next 6 years, I lived the progression of alcoholism. And so therefore, you know, I am very, very much in love with newcomers who try so hard or who have to come back or who are not able. I mean, I admit it every day, the first step. I'm powerless over alcohol, and my life is unmanageable. However, it was very hard for this alcoholic to make a decision to either go to the liquor store or go to AA. Every day, those were tormented decisions, because if you go to the liquor store, you get this ease that goes down you for a few minutes. And then your problems come right back. By the end of my drinking, I was in terrible shape. My teaching job I was called in about my absences. My husband and I had separated because I had a blackout and ordered him to leave. I mean, he interfered with my drinking. When I came to, he told me the next morning what I had said, and it wasn't very good. I didn't remember it. And this man, you know, we were very much in love when we got married, but drinking spoiled that whole relationship. And he had bleeding ulcers when he moved out, and and I was thrilled because I could drink now the way I, and of course, it was all over. You know, AA, once you come to AA, if you don't get it, it gets you, and it certainly spoils your drinking, and, you know, you find that there are people here that you want what they have, and you just keep coming. The year before I got sober, I was put away in a mental hospital by my parents because I guess I overdosed on some pills and while drunk, and they put me in a psychiatric hospital where I was administered shock treatment. And you know, that is a very medieval way to treat an alcoholic, but believe me, I think they knew that they didn't know what else to do. So when I came to, I had completely forgotten about what happened, you know, the year before. And I guess I resigned from my teaching job after 7 years of, I guess it was after 7 years of teaching, and went into this hospital. And in this hospital, my medical insurance ran out after 6 months, so they sent me to a state hospital. And it was at this hospital that I came thinking, you know, how did I get here? A nice girl from Bronxville in Westchester and with wonderful parents, and here I am in a locked ward of a state hospital. And you know, the attitude of most alcoholics are, why fight it, join it. And naturally I met the sickest guy in that hospital, and the two of us snuck pints, you know, and drank when we got little walks outside. And that was the way I was at that time. And I didn't want anyone to come see me. And my mother, who went to college up in Vassar, had to come up there to visit me in the same town where I was in Poughkeepsie. And it was horrible. And then at the end of my stay, my parents said, well, we'll take you in. I was 28 years old, and I was just thinking, it's kind of painful because my son now is 22, and I've been thinking about how we could get him out of the house, you know. It's because I was thinking, look at me in my 20s. I was a real, you know, up. I mean, an active alcoholic. And I came home to my parents' house, and with a lot of hostility. I mean, there's one thing worse. There's a drinking alcoholic, and then there's a resentful one who doesn't like anything. You know, you've lived with them, or you have children like that, and who just gritting this hanging on to life. And so I saved my money and 6 months later moved into New York. And I started going out with a guy who was a civilian. And by then I was divorced, had gone to Juarez to get this divorce, and drank a little tequila on top of anabuse. You know, it's amazing. I'm standing up here, guys, with all the abuses. And after I got into New York City, I started going out with a guy who was this civilian, and we went skiing a lot in the mountains, and he knew I had a drinking problem, and I started returning to AA. And you know, if you're young and you're in a crowd, and they pass around the marijuana, and they pass around, they share the beer, and you're in a skiing society, it's very hard for anyone to say no. It was hard for me, no matter how much trouble I just shared with you. And eventually I took a puff of the marijuana and drank some hard cider, and the compulsion that they talk about of alcohol gets set off. And I had been out of the hospital about a year, and within a week, I was drunk again. And I remember that last drunk I went on because I couldn't go skiing. I was sick. I didn't know how to take care of myself when you have a fever without having whiskey. And he went skiing without me. And so I was alone in my apartment in New York, and it's so easy to buy a bottle of whiskey to help you along. And when I got that bottle of whiskey, I knew it was over. I called this friend of mine. This was January 27th, 1969. I called this friend of mine, and she came and 12-stepped me. And she was a member of the Trafalgar Group in New York, and she came with a man, and they sat there while I shipped through my last drunk. And on January 28th, 1969, shaking, I went to the Murray Hill Group of AA. I said I drank, And I spent the whole evening in the girls' room with the dry heaves and the shakes. And the next day I saw a doctor, and he helped me with anti-convulsive pills. And my father came into town. Of course, my father always had the reddest face, I always thought, in Manhattan, because he was always had a few drinks. But he said, "Pack your bags. You're going away." And I said, "I can't, Dad. I'm doing it the AA way." And that was my day of surrender. And I surrendered to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was the greatest day of my life, because I began a new life. I do anything that you said to do to not drink. And every alcoholic in this room and all the rooms around the world has to come to that point to become sick and tired of being sick. Some people, it's their first meeting, they are sick and tired of being sick. And other people have to live the progression, and there are other people that just never get it. And I'm so lucky that I got it. I got into this group, the Trafalgar Group, in 1969, and it was a great group. I think I got my sobriety in the kitchen, making coffee, before the meeting, after the meeting. We had a lot of fun. I had no concentration. I mean, if you asked me to read a book, I could only read a paragraph. I couldn't sit still in meetings. I had to get up at least 10 times to get coffee, and my attention span was very, very limited. I had a teaching job in Manhattan in a private school, and I remember the first year in AA, some of the teachers said to me, "Where do you go? I mean, I always say I'm meeting so-and-so, or I'm going up here, and where do you go?" I said, "Oh, I just meet a lot of people through other people." And I maintain my anonymity there. This school was a wonderful school that I worked in for five more years. And it was the perfect place. Eventually, I was able to tell the director, when we were in a car together, some literature, AA literature, fell out of my car, and I, out of the glove compartment, at least it wasn't a pint anymore. And I was able to tell her that I was in AA, and I remember inviting her to an open meeting, and she came with me, and I had to tell my story like today. I left out the shock treatments and the... And she said to me, "Oh, Susan, you never could have been that bad." And, you know, it's so, and I always remember I would invite my mother and father to some of my anniversaries and the open meetings, and they would come. And my mother would say, "Those stories are just so terrible, Susan. They're just..." Because I remember once she told one of her friends in AA, she said, "You know, Susan thinks I'm an alcoholic." And she said, "Because I drink alone." And I tell Susan that, I mean, I've nobody else to drink with. Her father is dead. So, I mean, I drink by myself. And so when she, I mean, but she thought that was, you know, amusing to... realize that, and of course this other woman who was an AA member said to my mother, "Oh, Jean, you're not an alcoholic." So I let that go, and it was very important for me when I came in to say, "I have the illness, I accept it, and it's my illness," and to not diagnose my parents. I began to hear a lot of meetings that I went to where people would diagnose their parents, but I can't. My sobriety was wonderful from the beginning, because I've always loved AA. my first sponsor, I did the steps, the first five steps with, she got drunk. And so I got another sponsor immediately, and she's been my sponsor ever since, all these 28 years. And I've really been blessed because she's been through all my experiences, and I've been through hers. And there's something wonderful about that continuity. And the woman who carried the message to me, Virginia, is my other sponsor. And these two women have been such an instrumental influence in my life. I mean, I've shared everything with them, and I continue to call them with questions. Generally, my sponsor, Adrian, will say, turn it over. And third step. And this is, she has many, many sponsees, and I think that I must have inherited the same type of behavior that she has, because I've inherited, I sponsor a lot of women, and I'm very lucky to be so involved with women in the program of recovery that works. My first sponsee was Kathy, and she asked me when I was sober 8 months to be her sponsor, and it was just like, you were asking. This was the most wonderful thing that had come to me. I mean, nobody had asked me anything. I was just, a person, what are we going to do with her type of person. And all of a sudden, someone says, would you be my sponsor? That was like a gift from God. And she and I were going to the intergroup dinner together again this year. Hal will be there. What about AA? I don't think that I, in the beginning I went every day, and it was so hard for me since I was an apartment drinker and never a bar drinker, that I had on weekends in New York City, I had to go three or four times on a Saturday, and sometimes midnight meetings. I was really kind of nervous to be on my own because of my drinking pattern. And eventually, I could stay home one night, maybe Wednesday, and wash my hair and do my nails or something. Most of the time I was in AA meetings, and I've never not enjoyed an AA meeting. The Trafalgar group I joined had a step meeting, and I can still name all the people that were in that room, including John was there, including about 28 years ago. And it was a wonderful step meeting. And most of the people that are in that room, that were in that room, are sober today or gone to the big meeting in the sky. So, I mean, that's an incredible thing, but most of these people are sober from that step meeting. And it was a wonderful meeting and a great group. And they got me busy right away. So I was the co-secretary, and then did things for the group. After a couple of years, I moved to California, and I remember my sponsor saying to me, well, you can always come back. And that was a good thing for me, because I moved and I had to take myself with me. And, that's quite an awakening to go to a new place and have to get active in AA in another place. And I did that. And I joined the Team 20 group in California. And that's when I went to my first ICIPA convention. I was 32 years old. And it was so terrific to be in a room with people my age and younger who were having fun staying sober. And I was just absolutely overwhelmed. I was absolutely in awe also that they told me that I could ask somebody to dance, that it was an equal society. I never knew that, but so I did. I started to learn that I could talk to men again and dance sober. And little by little, I began to make some very good male friends in AA, and everything was going wonderful until I had a relationship with the gang I hung out with. And then you know that sometimes problems begin then when you're into a relationship. So when I was out in California, I lived with a trombone player. And he was much older than I was, and eventually after 2 years, I left the relationship and came back to New York, which my sponsor said was okay, and got my old teaching job back. And when I was sober 5 years, the man who wrote Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers told me to go to the General Service Office and fill out an application. So I did that, and I was offered a job at the office. I remember talking to my sponsor about this, saying, what will it be like working for AA around, you know, for a job? I love my AA life. I don't want it to be spoiled. And I teach children. I don't know what it will be like working with adults. Well, let me tell you, we're all children at times, so recovering together. So it wasn't so bad. But my first year at the office, I was going to quit 5 or 6 times. I mean, it just didn't seem to me. I had a lot of tears and adjustment because, you know, the group conscience in your home group is one thing, but then when you get into a group conscience of the staff at the office, as well as delegates to the conference, as well as trustees, and sometimes they would sit around and discuss young people, for instance, and I thought, well, how do they know? They're all 70 years old, but things like that, I could then begin to see the only way AA can improve is a lot of talk and workshops and committee meetings and the group conscience decision. If you're an impatient person, it's probably not a good idea to serve on one of those types of committees that requires a group conscience. Maybe you're better at being the treasurer or the coffee maker or the prison work. If you're in a committee that requires a group conscience, you might be in the committee for hours coming up with a group conscience. And I think because I'm always in awe that it does come out the way God intended it to be, that I believe in this group conscience and that there are no bosses in AA and that there are groups around the world guided by 12 steps and 12 traditions, and that nothing is going to change, not one word of the steps or traditions, without all the groups participating and voting on that. And I trust that. I trust that AA is just fine, and so am I. When I was, after working at the office for a while, I got married again to an AA member. And we had a 10-year relationship, and this man was, he was a very well-spoken Irishman, and my name went from, my maiden name was Schlotterman, then I went to Coyle, and then I went to Daly. And I'm the only one at the office who's changed my name 3 times, but I'm still the same Susan, I promise you. we got married, and we had, with my husband Don, we had I had stepchildren to deal with, and having to learn how to cook for large families and mother-in-laws and all sorts of things. And, you know, I saw these problems in my home group, the Trafalgar group. I talked about it, and I did everything I could to solve my problems. We were very blessed, as Nell talked about today, and Cleve. We were blessed with a little girl when I was 38 years old, we had a terrible tragic happening with our daughter, and she died at 2 years old. And it was an AA. It was a very upsetting time, Dave remembers, and I know that that was one of my black periods, but I could not, the thing that kept me together was this great love that I feel in the room today, this great love by saying, we're here for you. And I remember the Al-Anons and Lois Wilson and all these people encouraged me. And so I got better. And believe it or not, within a few weeks, I had a new sponsee, and she required a great deal of attention. And these things are absolute blessings for people who need to be busy. This woman is still sober. I had dinner with her the other night. And I look back, and I think that I celebrate my daughter's life. I don't grieve it. You know, 10 years ago, I couldn't stand up here and talk that way without getting extremely, but I know that it talks about in this book that there are new experiences for every alcoholic to experience if you don't close off yourself from other people. And this experience has helped a lot of people, because I remember receiving a letter. This talks about carrying the AA message, the theme this weekend. I remember receiving a letter from a woman in New Zealand who heard about my loss, and she had lost her son. And we wrote back and forth, and we met at the International Convention, and we've been friends ever since. You just don't really know if you keep everything in, you know, your experience is yours, the whole thing is that we get through this together without drinking, and you have always been there for me. That's why I never gave up. And our marriage was very, hard after that, so we separated. And after we separated, I got involved with this project of adopting a child, which you've heard this weekend from our speakers. I did something very racy, and but it was really quite a challenge. I think if I'd thought it through, I probably would. The way some people, if you think things through sometimes, but if it feels like it's God's will, do it. And, you know, when you're younger, taking risks are very, very, very interesting if it feels like the next right thing that the book talks about. So I adopted this little boy, Paz, and he came to the country from El Salvador, and that was in 1984. And it was exactly at the same time that he came here that he was 8 years old. And it was exactly at the same time that he came that I coordinated the World Service meeting of AA in New York. And I met my the love of my life, Eric, from Norway. It was really such a wonderful chance for me to really get back into a busy life again with my 20 sponsees, coordinating the World Service meeting of AA, a new child at home, and a beginning of a love affair with a Norwegian. So we communicated back and forth. He was representing Norway, and we corresponded by tape, and he sent me tapes on As Bill Sees It. He would read it out loud, and then he would give me his interpretation, and then I would pick something and I'd send it to him by tape. And to me, I mean, whenever I got one of those tapes, I was just like, I'd run up into my bedroom and play it. And he had such a deep, sexy voice, you know. And my son was always saying to me, you know, when are you going to come out of the room and get dinner, you know. But Eric was really, it was a great blessing for me to meet Eric. He had a great sense of humor, and you know, as they say, I mean, sometimes there were many days that the only thing that I think we agreed on was the preamble of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, we did agree that that worked, and he asked me to marry him, and I didn't know whether I should leave GSO, and I didn't know if he wanted to come to the United States. So we were back and forth, and we went to a convention together, and he came here, and I went over there with our son, and we just finally decided to get married in New York. And he came to this country in 1987, and we had... I would go to these weekends, like I remember coming to the North Carolina Assembly, and of course Eric and Paz would take care of the home. And I would call up and I would say, how are things at home? And he would say, well, it's very peaceful here since you've gone. So, and I could more or less see that they could do what they wanted. They could have pizza and put their feet up on the table and all the things. And it was a wonderful time we had together. Our son grew up, and we had a lot of trouble in the different places that he went to school. Private schools, and that was another thing. Eric and I could never agree on the education and of our son, because he came from a country where education is free, and eventually he got out of high school and he came here to North Carolina and went to college here for 2 years. And now he has dropped out of school, and he's going, he's a flight attendant with an airline. So when we were coming over here on Thursday, we shared a cab together. I went to one airport, and he went to the other airport, and got on a plane to go to Israel. And he's a terrific flight attendant, and I'm very proud of him. So... had a lot of differences, my husband and me, but we had a great deal of love for each other, and we spent every summer in Norway, and where he could be with his family, and we went to meetings in Norway and meetings in New York. Eric only went to one meeting a week because he got sober on one meeting a week, and I went to four or five meetings a week, and that's because that's how I got sober. And I would say to him, you know, you need to go to some more meetings with me, or let's go. And he would say to me, one meeting a week is enough. You go to all those meetings all the time, and I really don't see much improvement. So I think that. And after a while, you know, we would sit down and say, we need to use the third step together, and we need to let go of each other and accept each other as we are. Of course, that is always the situation in relationships, about acceptance of your partner. And I have a great deal of respect and love for Eric. He was an extremely spiritual man, and we started to go to church together, and my husband went to work for a church in New York. And once he went to work for that church, that was where my AA group met. He was managing the building, so I had to leave the Trafalgar group after 17 years and join another group because there was kind of a conflict of interest. And I joined a group near the apartment and the 79th Street Workshop. And I've been a member of that group for the last 9 years. I still go to the Trafalgar group on Tuesday night, but since I'm on the church board now, I feel it's still a conflict of interest. I am active in church now as a session member. And, you know, these things I've never asked for. They've just come to me. People ask about how can you can't have AA all the time. And that is true. It's important to have a balance. And I love the theater. I love movies. I love this church work and practicing a spiritual life, and I also love doing things with other AA people and meeting my sponsees. My husband Eric was diagnosed with cancer 3 years ago, and we divided our time between Norway and New York, and He was very courageous in his fight for, I'm just really very glad that we had this time together. That was 10 years. And so my husband died around the time of the General Service Conference in April, and I remember how wonderful the delegates were to me in the beginning of the week, and again, how inspired I was that I could only be very sad because of losing my best friend and my partner. So when I had to go over to Norway and take care of some of his affairs, and the AA people there have always been extended their AA hand to me. And last month I was over there in May at their 50th anniversary, which was in Beitostølen, Norway, and there were 500 people there celebrating 50 years of sobriety. I was representing the GSO office, and they asked me to just say a few words from AA in the United States and Canada, which I did, and it was translated. And it was such a privilege to be there. I know, of course, so many of them, and I was with this old very old man, Oscar Olson, who is the doctor of AA, or doctor non-AA in Norway. And he sent so many drunks to AA in Norway. And there he was, 88 years old, telling the AA story and the history. And it's right here this weekend in your brochure about George and AA getting started in Norway, and George, a Norwegian, went over there and started the first AA group. And then here I am this weekend, 50 years in North Carolina, and I feel, you know, that there's just so much attachment of being 50 years in Norway and then 50 years this weekend. The woman who trained me at GSO, she just celebrated 50 years of sobriety, Anne M., and I had dinner with her a few weeks ago. And I was thinking, you know, if I don't drink and I don't die, I may have 50 years myself. So one never knows. These are not my goals. My goals are to walk humbly and usefully under God's grace and to remember that the next opportunity that comes is going to, I will keep my mind open and my heart open. My son thinks that I need to have a new boyfriend because I'm picking on him. And I said to her, so, you know, this last weekend I bought this book, How Stella Got Her Groove Back, or something like that. I left it on the airplane, so I have to buy it again. But I'm wondering if it's going to be How Susan Got Her Groove Back. I don't know, but I know that my husband Eric would say, listen, honey, you're just doing fine. Just turn it over. So I think that when it says things like this in the big book about the fellowship, I can, it says, yes, there, this is on page 152. Yes, there is a substitute, and it is vastly more than that. It is a fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. There you will find release from care, boredom, and worry. Your imagination will be fired. Life will mean something at last. The most satisfactory years of your existence lie ahead. Thus we find the fellowship, and so will you. And in the 12 and 12, it says, about AA's 12 steps, these little studies of AA's 12 steps now come to a close. We have been considering so many problems that it may appear that AA consists mainly of racking dilemmas and troubleshooting. To a certain extent, that's true. We've been talking about problems because we are problem people. We have found a way up and out, and who wish to share our knowledge of that way with all who can use it. For it is only by accepting and solving our problems that we can begin to get right with ourselves and with the world about us, and with him who presides over us all. Understanding is the key to right principles, and right action is the key to good living. Therefore, the joy of good living is the theme of AA's 12 steps. You know, everyone, I would not change one day of my sober life. It has been mountaintop experiences. I have never been so privileged as to love and be loved unconditionally. I can't help but express to you that we are all getting ready for more and more mountaintop experiences. We need you. Share your experience with others. Be kind and courteous to all. How much I love you. Thank you for my sobriety.